From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. As policymakers in Washington continue to haggle over the future of health care, the head of the American Health Policy Institute offers ideas about the best way to approach reform. A bipartisan group in Raleigh is backing the STOP Act. It's a measure that steps up the fight against opioid abuse. You'll learn details. A former UNC Tar Heel says the competition that has made college basketball so great in North Carolina could have positive impacts on public education, too. You'll learn why. Plus, you'll learn why court cases are causing delays in payments tied to the state's eugenics compensation program. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
It's called Direct Primary Care, an innovative approach to delivering medical services. And now a new report from the John Locke Foundation concludes that if we used direct primary care more, we'd see better outcomes for patients with chronic diseases, and further, we could actually cut the incidence and severity of disabilities. Catherine Restrepo is the author of this new policy report. She's the director of healthcare policy for the Locke Foundation. Catherine, welcome back.
Thank you.
Before we talk about the details, and this is pretty exciting because you're talking about having a real impact on, on people's health, explain to us what DPC, as it's known, really is. How does it work?
Yeah, direct primary care, DPC, as you say, it's like a healthcare gym membership. Just think of it that way. So in exchange for a monthly fee, an average monthly fee is $75 for a patient. In return for that fee, that patient has around-the-clock care to their primary care physician. And it also includes this defined package of basic primary care services. So that can be EKG testing, that can be skin biopsies, joint injections, comprehensive annual physicals, and the list can really go on. And these doctors also offer generic medications. They can prescribe them in North Carolina and in 44 other states, for that matter, in-house. And they can also negotiate discounts with lab companies at wholesale cost to do labs.
You could actually text your doctor or email your doctor
get
a quick response?
Email your doctor. And, you know, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of primary care practices where you have patient portals and you can check in with your doctor through a patient portal and look at your electronic medical record. But the key difference here is that these doctors, they're so price transparent and they're making healthcare much more affordable for low and middle income families who are struggling to pay for their health insurance premiums. And that's simply because they do not accept insurance. They're completely removing primary care from insurance. And that whole concept can make health insurance so much more affordable for more people.
Now, you've been digging into the data on this, and it's a fascinating report. It's available at johnlocke.org. You've been looking at what would happen if we not only increase the use of direct primary care, but what's been happening from the providers who are already using it. And you say that if we used it more, we could actually help folks who have these chronic diseases. Explain that.
Yes. And when you look at this model, people think, oh, this model, it's similar to concierge medicine. These doctors charge a premium. People have to have disposable income to have this around the care access and be able to afford that. But we're only healthy. You know, these doctors are only cherry picking healthy patients that have the money to access them. But that's really quite the opposite. If you look at this model, the patients really that would benefit the most, who would get the most out of their monthly healthcare gym membership, if you want to refer to it as that, are people with multiple chronic conditions. I mean, nationwide, more than one in two people are diagnosed with just one chronic disease. So many people have multiple or known as comorbid patients. And when you can spend more time, I mean, time is the value here in the direct care model. When you can spend more time with your physician, that improves access to care, and it can really reduce healthcare costs downstream, the specialty care visits, the unnecessary hospitalization visits, or unnecessary referrals to specialists as well.
So let's just be clear, too, when you're talking about people who have chronic issues and multiple issues, mm-hmm. let's say maybe someone has high blood pressure.
Right, diabetes.
Diabetes. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've got a problem with their thyroid. So they've got these different conditions
yes.
that are all affecting them in different ways. And you're saying if they use direct primary care and have this very easy access to their doctor,
right.
it really keeps it under control better?
Yes, because 50% of people with high blood pressure, or in the report it will state other statistics, that there are a high percentage of people who have chronic conditions, and you can have a chronic condition and can be managed. It can be managed well, meaning you're in compliance with your medications, you're going to see your primary care physician, you're engaged with your health, you're managing your disease well. But there are many people out there, simply because of the access and time issues that many patients are facing the healthcare system, where they have these chronic conditions and they're not being controlled. They're not controllable. And that's, again, because of lack of time. So more an investment at the primary care level, more time with their physician, can really rein in the spending on patients with healthcare or with chronic conditions, and improve the patient's overall health.
So in the policy report, you kind of lay out the data that you just mm-hmm. described, but you also then say that if we were able to do this, and the fact that this helps people and would help
yes.
more people manage chronic issues, it's going to lead to a lesser number of people who have disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
How is that?
Well, because if you have chronic conditions and they go untreated or go unmanaged, that can lead to disabilities. For example, kids with asthma, I mean, that can lead to limited mobility, limited activity they can do. People who are diabetic and their holistic care is not taken care of in a timely or an appropriate manner, that can lead to foot amputations or other problems, which leads to other disabilities.
This sounds really exciting to me. It really
yes.
does, because I happen to have a number of people in my family who are dealing with
mm-hmm.
multiple issues, and it's a problem. They're constantly trying to see different doctors, and the doctors are having to talk about how the medications interact and all that. It,
right.
it can become a
yeah,
really
exactly.
issue.
Yeah, exactly. And, it can have such a greater impact because the report also spells out, and a lot of academic medical literature says that there's more of a stronger association with lower income people having, being diagnosed with chronic illnesses. And that, again, goes back to lack of access, adequate access to health care. And if this were incorporated into Medicaid somehow, where there's still, you still have preserved that relationship between the physician and the patient, this can really be an impact for taxpayers, that are funding Medicaid, and more importantly, for the Medicaid patients themselves.
There's so many aspects to this whole thing, and one of them that you write about, Catherine, is the issue of government actually using this. I know that you have
yes.
talked previously about, wouldn't it be interesting if the state health plan perhaps
mm-hmm.
took advantage of this, but we know that Union County, the government employees in Union County have
yes.
access to this as an option. How's it working?
Yes, it's been working great. Within 1 year, they've saved over $1 million in healthcare claims, and that's just on 44 to 48% of Union County workers that have chosen a direct care physician as their primary care provider. And again, these direct care physicians, they don't accept insurance, but the great thing about Union County, or from an employer standpoint, is that when they offer direct care as a value-added benefit option, it still works alongside their traditional health insurance plan, so they can still have access to specialists in-network that their health plan offers for specialty care or hospital care.
So it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's a true what people call a wraparound policy. So everything wraps around the insurance plan itself that's designed by Union County, because they are a self-insured employer, meaning they're at risk for all the claims they incur by their workers. They're able to restructure their healthcare benefits, where it wraps around primary care benefits and it just includes specialty and things for catastrophic or unforeseen medical events.
Lastly, Catherine, how prevalent is this in terms of the number of doctors who are going this route, just
mm-hmm.
saying no to insurance, I'm going to deal with my
yeah.
patients?
Well, it's growing for sure. I mean, still a very niche market. I mean, only about 30 doctors are practicing in the state of North Carolina, maybe between 3,000 and 5,000 nationwide, depending on if it's considered pure direct care, if they don't accept insurance, or if that's a concierge doctor who does do insurance but charges that monthly retainer fee.
It's all laid out in Catherine Restrepo's new policy report. Catherine, thank you. Great
thank
report.
You.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's hard to read a newspaper, watch a TV newscast, or listen to talk radio without hearing something about the future of American health care. As policymakers debate the merits of replacing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, we're joined by an analyst with expertise on that topic. Tevi Troy is CEO of the American Health Policy Institute. He's also a former deputy secretary in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and an aide in George W. Bush's White House. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So this obviously is one of the big news items that we've been dealing with really ever since the election, and we knew that Donald Trump would be the new president, is what's going to happen in the future of government involvement in American health care. As you're watching this debate, what are you focusing on?
I'm focusing on making sure that we maintain the key building blocks of the American health policy system. So, for example, 177 million people get their health care through their employers. You want to make sure that that continues. A lot of people get health care through Medicare and Medicaid. You want to make sure, to the extent that we're committing resources to meet our promises to the elderly and to the impoverished, that we have systems in place that are maintaining those systems, but in a responsible way. Obviously, I think there's too much spending and too much fraud in some of those programs, and I think they can be reined in. But they are, you put those together, and those are the basic building blocks where the vast majority of Americans get their coverage. And then you have to worry about where the people who've been falling through the cracks. And that was the whole reason for the ACA, the Obamacare debate, is that too many people have been falling through the cracks, people who aren't employed or people who don't have an employer that provides health insurance. And then so you have to think about those people and how to fit them in, but that doesn't necessarily have to govern how the entire rest of the system operates. I think it's short-sighted to say there's a group of people who fall through the cracks and we're going to remake the entire system for that group. We need to focus a program or a series of programs or a policy approaches that help those specific people without necessarily upending the entire apple cart.
A lot of the debate these days has been about repealing and or replacing the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and some people have said, why not just repeal the law that was passed in 2010 and go back to what we had before 2010. Is that even possible?
It really isn't possible. Look, the Affordable Care Act has a lot of problems with it, huge premium increases, I think a lot of incursions on liberty, including the individual mandate and the employer mandate, limited choices in its networks in terms of insurers falling out. So there's a lot of problems with the ACA, but there were a lot of problems with our system beforehand, including way too many people who were uninsured. So I think there are ways to get to a more value-driven system, a system that uses our heavy spending on healthcare. You know, we spend about 18% of our GDP on healthcare, which is twice what our European allies spend about. And so we can use those resources more effectively to get more care to more people. So I don't want to go back to the old system. I don't want to use the ACA. I think we need a third way going forward.
That is the voice of Tevi Troy. He is CEO of the American Health Policy Institute, also a former deputy secretary in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services during the Bush administration. As we've heard the various debates about how to move forward, are you mainly encouraged, discouraged, a mix about what people are talking about? Are they focusing on the right things?
I'm always discouraged when things are too focused on the politics and does this party win or does that party win. I think it was unfortunate that the ACA went forward with only Democratic votes, and that meant that this unipartisan approach didn't include Republicans. And that's a problem because throughout our history, we have had controversies over social welfare legislation, but all previous pieces of social welfare legislation have passed with bipartisan support, which meant that the American people swallowed it afterwards and moved on and said, okay, this is something that they agreed on in Washington and now we're going forward. Given the unipartisan approach of the ACA, there's now a sense that the Republicans are going to do it with no Democratic votes, in large part because the Democrats say we absolutely refuse to cooperate. I would think that in President Trump, you'd have someone who Democrats might look at and say, this guy's not a traditional Republican. Perhaps we can make deals with him. But there's been no interest thus far from the Democrats. So I would like to see a sensible but also bipartisan approach going forward that really allowed the American people to say, okay, both parties have had their say. They've worked together on this, and this is the way we're going to work with our health system going forward. I'm not seeing evidence of that right now.
One of the things that has struck me in talking to people who are experts in your field, the field of healthcare, is some people saying, you know, the Affordable Care Act spent a lot of time, a lot of political resources, a lot of money, and really dealt with health insurance but didn't necessarily address some of the key problems in health care itself. Are we missing the boat if we're focusing only on the insurance aspect and not on things like access to care and improving the care that we have?
Yeah, the ACA said it was going to be about bending the cost curve down, but it was really based on coverage. And the ACA's proponents say correctly that more people are covered as a result of the ACA. But when you subsidize something and you make it illegal not to do that something, then you're going to have more of it. And it's just a basic fact of life. And so by doing this focus on coverage only, I think the ACA did a disservice and didn't really look at ways to improve the system. Now, when Republicans are looking for their own approach, they obviously have to deal with what they've been handed to in the form of the ACA, and that shapes their approach as well. So I think the problems, the original sin, if you will, of the ACA continues to cause problems going forward.
So as the legislation moves forward that would change, repeal, replace Obamacare, does that mean there's still going to need to be some work done outside of that whole context to deal with American healthcare and government's proper role?
Oh, absolutely. But I think that some of the key things that have to happen could be led by the private sector. I think we need to move to a more value-based healthcare system. What does that mean? It means where people take cost and quality issues into account when they are making their own decisions. Right now, with a heavily third-party-based payment system, people don't think about where they're going to get their care or where the doctors have the best prices or where the doctors provide the best value. If you had a more value-based driven system, then you would potentially be able to drive down costs and drive quality up. We've seen this in every other form of our economy. I mean, if you look at the iPhones or if you look at TV cameras or even radio equipment, all these things, the quality keeps going up and the cost keeps going down because of the power of consumerism. We have not unleashed the power of consumerism in our healthcare system largely because of third-party payments.
And I understand that in the parts of healthcare that aren't affected by third party, you actually do see things like the laser eye surgery.
Yeah. Yeah. LASIK's a great example. Here is something where the technology continues to improve. The price continues to go down because people pay out of pocket. And what does that mean? It means they price compare and they will drive from one end of a state to another end of a state. They might drive to another state. Sometimes they may drive to another country to get better services. And it's because of this power of consumerism that the providers have to improve their product and reduce their costs. If you have third-party payments, then you're going to have providers who know that they effectively have either a monopoly or a disengaged consumer base. And the consumer base is just going to go wherever they go because that's where their insurance company tells them or because that's closest to their house. It's not necessarily getting the best care at the best price.
In the brief time that we have left, how confident are you that once this debate on Capitol Hill is concluded, we're going to end up with something better than what we have now under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, once you have the political process at work, I lose a lot of confidence in the ability to get better things. I think the Affordable Care Act has been extremely problematic, so I'm somewhat optimistic that we'll have something better than it, but I don't think we're going to solve all the problems of American healthcare with government action.
One of the people who's going to be watching that government action very closely is Tevi Troy, CEO of the American Health Policy Institute, also former Deputy Secretary in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers want to take more steps to fight opioid abuse. One option, a piece of legislation called the STOP Act. State Senator Jim Davis explains the problem.
Every year this epidemic takes a painful toll on our families and our communities across North Carolina. Every day, four North Carolinians die from a medication or drug overdose. 36 are hospitalized, and 64 are taken to emergency rooms. The number of statewide opioid overdose deaths has grown by nearly 400% in 7 years. Drug overdose is now the number one cause of accidental death, surpassing vehicle crashes.
Another Republican legislator, Representative Greg Murphy, is also a physician.
Enough is enough, and it is time that we turn the tables on this scourge that has paralyzed our state. My life's goal has been to serve others as a physician, but I am here today in a unique position as both a physician and a legislator to help provide leadership to our state's health care providers as we, the ones who actually prescribe legal opioids, take ownership and leadership on this issue. It is the hope and the intention that by common sense legislative restriction of some opioid prescribing habits, that we will slow the flow of opioids being misused.
Democratic Attorney General Josh Stein supports the STOP Act.
In addition to this incalculable human cost, the society, our society, is incurring billions in economic costs. And the problem is worsening by the year. This must stop, and the STOP Act is an important first step in this regard. To successfully confront the opioid epidemic, we need to implement a multifaceted approach that includes better prevention, treatment, and enforcement. That means smarter prescribing, more funding and focus on treatment and recovery, and smarter enforcement to aggressively go after the dealers and traffickers who are profiting on people's misery and death.
Republican Senator Tom McInnes adds a personal story.
This epidemic has personally impacted my family. We lost a beautiful, vibrant, absolutely wonderful son to this epidemic. And it started because of an automobile accident where he broke a couple of bones. He was given a vial of these horrid, horrid addictive drugs. And he started a downhill spiral that ended up with the loss of his life. Now, it started because he was given about 30 of these pills. And if you get these pills through any reason, you're either going to hate the first five or you're going to love all 30 of them.
That's Senator Tom McInnes, one of the supporters of a bill called the STOP Act. It aims to help fight opioid abuse in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Spend much time in North Carolina and you'll learn about the intense college basketball rivalry among UNC, NC State, and Duke. Our next guest has some experience with that rivalry, and he says the competition that has made these basketball teams so good should be applied in other areas, especially education. Richard Vinroot is a former mayor of Charlotte, former Republican candidate for governor in North Carolina, and a pioneer in North Carolina's public charter school movement. Thanks for joining us.
Mitch, I'm glad to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we talk about how education can help, or how competition can help in education, we should tell people that you do have some firsthand experience with this rivalry in college basketball. Remind us of how that is.
I played for one of the rivals. I played for Coach Smith at North Carolina in the early 60s, and so I learned firsthand how much we wanted to beat NC State and Duke and vice versa, and how good that was for basketball in this area. Within about 26 miles, there are three of the greatest programs in college basketball history with 12 national championships to show for it over the last half century. And it's all born out of competition between each of those schools wanting to beat the other, wanting to be better and have a better program. And I believe in competition. I believe that's sort of the American way, and it's been good for college basketball and in the Tobacco Road area. Why not apply the same principles in public education?
Why do you think competition would end up being such a helpful tool for improving education?
Well, because like anything in life, you want to beat the other guy. You want to perform better. You want to succeed. I would love to be the only lawyer in my city. I would be lazy. I would not do good work. I would charge a lot for it, and you'd be stuck with me. But because there are 4,000 other lawyers in my city, I have to work darn hard to get my share of the work and to perform it well enough to keep my clients. and do the things that I hope I do well enough to be alive and well.
Now, you also have, in addition to the experience in the college basketball rivalry, you also do have experience in this idea of adding some level of competition to education, because you helped with the early days of charter schools in North Carolina.
I did. I was running for governor met a fellow named Bob Malden down in Rocky Mount, who had started a charter school there. I had no idea what a charter school was, and I came back to Charlotte after seeing what was going on there and convened a group of friends of mine, about 10 of us, Democrats, Republicans, black, white, men, women, and decided we would give it a try. And we created in the inner city of Charlotte a charter school. Now has about 1,500 very poor African-American children. It is now, 19, 20 years later, the best performing school for those kids in our part of North Carolina, and one of the one or two or three best in this state of North Carolina. But it was not easy. And we learned the hard way how hard education is. I think it's the hardest thing in the world to do is educate. But in North Carolina and in America, it's the most important thing. We either do it well and our state will succeed, or we do it poorly and we will not succeed. I think education is my dad used to say to me, the great equalizer. It's the thing that gives you an opportunity to compete and to succeed.
We are chatting with Richard Vinroot, former mayor of Charlotte, and as we mentioned, a pioneer in North Carolina's public charter school movement. Some people hear about school choice, public charter schools, opportunity scholarship vouchers and things of that sort, and say, hey, this is just robbing the public schools. This is taking money away from the traditional public schools. Why is that not the way they should look at it?
First of all, the money doesn't belong to the system. It belongs to those kids. When we in North Carolina decided to spend about $9,000 per child to educate that child, that money belongs to that child. Why shouldn't he or she or his or her parents be able to take that money and apply it where that young person can get the best possible education? Why should it be stuck with a system that in many cases is failing the child? It doesn't belong to the school system. It wasn't appropriated to a system for no reason. It was appropriated for a child that was coming to that school system school. So why not let that child take it somewhere else? In this case, we've let them take it to charter schools at about 85% of the dollars. If we go to a voucher, about 42 cents on the dollar. So we're giving actually less money to the child who leaves to choose another system, or a charter school or a private school with a voucher, and leaving a whole lot more money behind for the kids who chose not to leave the system. So why are they complaining about losing a child and losing less money to go with the child? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Another argument you often hear about school choice options is that they skim the cream of the crop off of the class of students, and the public schools are left with the hardest students to teach. Is there any merit to that?
Bunk. There are more poor kids, there are more minority children in charter schools than there are in the school system. That's not only true in North Carolina, it's not only true in Charlotte, it's true in America, across the country. The very idea that somehow the people who are leaving are those who are simply going to go out to some other school because they want to leave because they just want to change scenery is baloney. The kids that leave and the parents who leave are the most desperate of all. Why wouldn't the poorest leave? Why wouldn't the ones who need the help the most leave? Because they're trying to get something for their child that's not happening in a school system. That's just bogus. I mean, there have been evaluations of that by Stanford University, by University of Arkansas, by you name it, across the country, and every one of them has come to the same conclusion. There are more minority students and there are more poor kids in charter schools than there are left behind in the system. So, baloney.
Now, another thing that we've heard from advocates of school choice, including charter schools and opportunity scholarships, is that no, there is not an attempt to hurt the public schools. In fact, having all of this competition makes the public schools compete and will make them better.
That's exactly what happened at NC State and at Chapel Hill and at Duke. When Frank McGuire came in here, State got better to be able to perform and compete when before they hadn't won any national championships. When Carolina got in the act and won the first one, darn if State didn't come back and win one itself. Same thing for Duke. When Coach K got there, they began to win national championships. Now, To my way of thinking, I'd rather have no national championships at Duke and State and all of them at Chapel Hill.
As a Carolina grad myself, I agree with you.
As a Carolina guy. But,
it's unanimous in this
interview.
But
the fact is the competition made those schools better. And the fact is if the school systems are going to stay in business, they better be prepared to compete because the test scores now bear out the fact that the kids in charter schools are outperforming those in the system in this state and across the country. And in this state, they're doing it fairly dramatically with poorer and more minority students. They better get better or they can't stay in the business. Something's going to happen, and they are. They are already doing more things to try to keep those kids there and not lose the dollars that go with those children. That's exactly what I would do if I were a lawyer threatened with competition.
And couldn't this be seen as one way for those who want to improve the public schools to do it? If your goal is to improve the public schools, find a way to do it. How about more competition?
Let me give you an example. In Charlotte, Sugar Creek Charter School, which I and others founded, 1,500 kids now with 400 kids on a waiting list, outperforming all the schools in our area, is where the former superintendent sent every teacher and every principal from similar schools to see what we were doing, to try to borrow from our success. That's what you ought to do. And I'll tell you, when we find a school system school that's doing something better than we are, we're going to go there and look at them and watch them and learn from them as well. That's how it ought to work. And it's too important to our country and to our success to let a failing system be there by itself without somebody somehow showing us the way to get better. Too important.
That is the voice of Richard Vinroot, former mayor of Charlotte, a pioneer in North Carolina's public charter school movement. Once again, the idea being that competition, it's not just for basketball. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure thing. Thanks for asking me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A recent state Supreme Court ruling moves the ball forward in efforts to compensate victims of state-mandated sterilization. But several court cases remain to be resolved. The John Locke Foundation's John Guzet, who is the Director of Legal Studies, he's here to bring us up to date on this incredibly ugly period of North Carolina history. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
Remind our listeners what the State Eugenics Board was and did.
Well, this really is a shameful chapter. The State Eugenics Board was formed in 1933, but that wasn't actually the beginning of eugenics in North Carolina. Just in case any listeners aren't aware of it, eugenics means trying to engineer human biology. So that, and specifically in this case, by involuntarily sterilizing people who were thought unfit to reproduce. This was something that was a major plank in the platform of the progressive movement. They not only wanted to re-engineer society, they wanted to re-engineer the people who were going to make up that society. It was widely accepted as a valid thing to do, and it was done in many other states, and it was started in North Carolina as early as 1919. That's when the first eugenics law was passed. The first sterilization started, I think, in 1929. But the program really got underway in a major way with the passage of the law in 1933 that set up the State Eugenics Board. The Eugenics Board authorized agencies at the local, the county and the municipal level to sterilize people who met certain criteria for being unfit. Those were people epileptics, people who were thought to be either feeble-minded or somehow morally unfit to have children.
John, as you're describing this, if our listeners are like me, I mean, it's just horrific to even hear you describe that this was happening. This was sanctioned by the state of North Carolina. Other states did it as well, as you mentioned. Do we know about how many people in North Carolina were sterilized so that they could not have children?
We don't know exactly, but probably something on the order of about 8,000 people, almost all of them women. Some men were sterilized, but for whatever reason, the focus of the program was always on women. The thing that makes this especially shocking is this. You know, for people in the 20s and the 30s to think this was a good idea, it's hard to put ourselves in their mindset, but it was commonly accepted all over the world. Although, it has to be said, American progressives led the way. The Nazis, when they began their eugenics program, actually looked to America as an example for this. But the thing that makes the case in North Carolina so especially shocking is that, unlike most states, even after the end of the Second World War, when the horrors of Nazism had been revealed and most states decided they weren't going to go in for this anymore, North Carolina actually accelerated the program. We did more sterilizations between 1945 and when the program officially ended in, I think it was 1974, more sterilizations then than we'd done before. Thousands of people, mostly women, were sterilized in the 50s, the 60s, and even right into the 70s.
Now, let's fast forward into just a few years ago. The state legislature, there was a lot of stories written about this, so the state legislature really started to take notice, and a movement took hold to compensate the victims of this state-sanctioned sterilization. And the General Assembly approved a fund in order to do that. Tell us what has occurred. Have there been payouts to the victims of eugenics, and who is actually described as a victim?
Well, this is something that I think we at the John Locke Foundation can be especially proud of, because we were one of the groups that's been promoting this for a long time, many years before it finally passed in 2013. Soon after the legislation passed, some victims were compensated. Compensation began, but it was put on hold when these court cases arose. And the reason was, one of the unfortunate things about the way the legislation was written, it set a total amount rather than an amount per victim. And that amount was $10 million. They can't really pay people until they know how many victims there's going to be. And they won't know how many victims there are until these court cases get settled. There's two issues that have arisen and two sets of cases that are holding things up. In the one case, there are some people who were sterilized, but they weren't sterilized the way they ought to have been. That is to say, their sterilizations were illegal, even under the laws at the time. One of these women from Mecklenburg County was sterilized in the 70s, and it turns out that Mecklenburg County acted without going through the state eugenics board. So the way the law is written, she's not eligible, at least as under the letter of the law, because the board, the law says that it has to be for people sterilized under the authorization of that particular act, and she wasn't. She was illegally sterilized. That's not to say she doesn't deserve compensation. She probably has a civil case against Mecklenburg County, but the courts have said she's not eligible under the act. She has appealed that, and until that case gets resolved, we won't know what her status and the status of some others who are in a similar position will be. The other group are the heirs of people who died before June of 2013. The act says it's only going to pay compensation to victims who are alive on that date. And that's because otherwise there would be a huge number of heirs, and they're not going to deal with them. But some of those heirs, three groups of them, have sued saying that this is arbitrary and it violates their rights to due process and equal protection. They want to get their part of, they want to get a portion of the payout based on the fact that they are the heirs of somebody who was a victim who died before the cutoff date. So those are the cases.
Let's make sure that we understand. So a $10 million fund was set aside by the General Assembly to pay the victims, but until these two groups of cases are resolved, no payouts can take place?
They're on hold, and unless they figure out a way around it, they're going to stay on hold until they've got a complete list of victims.
John, of course, you're an attorney. So based on what you know about the facts of these two sets of cases, do you think that either one of these groups will prevail?
I doubt it, Donna, although I'm very sympathetic with the people in the first group. They were clearly victims. They ought to get compensated. But unfortunately, the law was not drafted in a way that took that possibility into consideration.
These are the folks who were sterilized at the county level versus
yes,
the state level.
But they were sterilized illegally, even under the State Eugenics Board Act. So that means if we are textualists and we follow the letter of the law, as I think we should, then something else needs to be done to help those people. As for the second group, the people who are simply heirs of victims, I don't really have a lot of moral sympathy for them, because I think that if we have a limited amount of money to pay to compensate victims, it ought to go to the living victims and not to people who didn't actually suffer injuries. I also think that the way the law is written, they don't have a very strong case. But the more important issue, it seems to me right now, is that this is just holding things up. And the longer we wait, the more victims die. It's terrible.
Now, a state Supreme Court ruling very recently has kind of jump-started this process again.
A little bit, Donna, but it's still very frustrating, because all that was involved in that particular ruling was a jurisdictional issue. The question was, where do those heirs of victims go to make their constitutional claims? And there were some dispute about that. That's been resolved by the state Supreme Court. So now they can bring their claims, but there's still going to have to be adjudication and a ruling, and that ruling might get appealed. So I'm afraid we're still years away from getting money into the hands of those poor victims who so far have received nothing or very little.
It just seems like it is so fundamentally wrong to do this to a person, to take away their right to reproduce.
Well, it certainly seems that way to you and me. And in fact, today, it seems that way even to most progressives, but we have to remember, and I don't think we should let progressives ever forget, that for decades and decades, starting at the end of the 19th century and going right up until the 1970s in our state, progressives thought it was perfectly all right.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Appreciate you listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.